Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Allison McDowell, who hails from my old hometown of Philly. And you don't have that Philly accent, though, Allison. Did you grow up in Philly?
No, I didn't. I've only been here since the early 90s. So,
where did you grow up? Ohio? Where'd you grow up?
Louisville, Kentucky, and Charlotte, North Carolina. So.
Oh, wow. But you don't have the twang. Okay. Well, Allison has been a fearsome researcher on the issues of transhumanism and technocracy. And I've wanted to interview for a long time, but Allison, every time I look at doing the interview, I think I have to be prepared. So I have to go through all your information on human impact and sustainable development goals and figure out how it connects to my information. And each time I looked at that, I said, that's a big job. And so, because if you look at the research, you've
done so much already. So.
Yeah, but it's you have really taken a major deep dive into a lot of material, which is so gruesome. You know, it takes a lot of energy to do what you do, and you've done a really good job of deep diving it and pulling it back out and making it a lot easier for the rest of us. Anyway, so one of the things I wanted to describe to you, I used to describe the language that they would use in Washington as pretzel talk. And so what you've been able to do is you can work through all the pretzel talk and then pull out the facts. And that's very helpful. So before we start, I just want to mention your website, which is wrenchesinthegear.com. Is it .com?
Yeah, it's Wrench in the Gears. Like
Wrench in the Gear. I love that name. And then you have a YouTube channel. You've got a Twitter channel.
I'm Philly852 on Twitter. And if you just put in my name, Allison McDowell, it's 1L, Allison.
You'll find it. But you do a lot of accessible interviews. And do you repost them on your YouTube channel, or can we find them just with a general search?
You know, I had created a playlist of other people's because I don't do a ton of my own interviews. And then they started pulling people's channels down. So then I started saying, like, I probably need my own copy.
Right.
So yeah, most of the stuff now is all on my own channel.
Okay. Well, when we publish this next week, we'll put up a link to your most recent interview, which was, I just finished watching, and it's excellent, but they'll be able to find a lot at the YouTube channel. Okay. So let me dive in. I wanted to start with my knowledge of poverty programs and sort of human impact programs. They've got all these new names for them, but mine is pretty old. It started when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing. And I just wanted to give you a couple concepts that very much relate to where they're now taking this. You know, we're going from the traditional poverty programs into a full-blown global Hunger Games kind of version. Anyway, so the first thing is I spent several decades trying to map out how government worked by place because I was trying to understand why we spent more and more money on poverty management, and poverty just kept growing. And so the question was, what's really causing this and what could you do about it? And what I discovered was that the government money had what I would call a negative return on investment. So you were essentially paying people to get stupider and to spend more time doing things that weren't productive, which made it easier to control them and sort of grow that population. And it was really a poverty growth and management model. So I'll give you an example. When I first got to HUD and I took the housing programs and the community programs that I was working with, what I discovered was that when the program had started, 70 cents on the dollar went into the community. By the time I got there, I estimated it was 29 cents. And if you looked at all that money, it was just more and more corporate contractors, more and more not-for-profits. It was just this incredibly expensive, high-cost, very paperful, you know, from the feds to the state to the local government, but tons of corporate contractors and tons of not-for-profit contractors. And in fact, if you dug in, there was black money, black budget money being siphoned out, so it got even more. You know, and then you layered on top of it all the mortgage fraud. And what you discovered was poor neighborhoods were simply just an opportunity to create job programs and steal huge amounts of money. So you had this negative return on investment machine. And what was amazing was how much of your establishment was financially dependent on keeping it going.
Yeah. Well, so, and that's the public-private partnership aspect, you know, the meshing of the government with the nonprofit sector and the corporate sector and the academic sector that enabled all of it.
So one of my favorite stories, we found all these neighborhoods where HUD was spending $250,000 per unit to rehab public housing or build new public housing, where we could take $50,000 and buy an FHA defaulted or foreclosed property and for $50,000 to $100,000 turn it into a home. And so you could get anywhere from 3 to 5 as many homes for $250,000 if you just took the money and moved it from one line item to another line item in the same block.
And they don't really want people to have stable housing.
No, they don't. So I took the whole presentation to the woman who was the assistant to the guy who ran the 250,000 public housing program. And I said, here's the map of Chicago. Here's the map of New Orleans. Here's the map. We had one other city. And I said, you know, we could get thousands of homes for, you know, we could get 1,000 more homes for free out of this if we just re-engineered it. And she looked at me straight in the eye and she said, but how would we generate fees for our friends?
Yeah.
Right.
It's terrible. I mean, Philadelphia is terrible here. I mean, and I have a friend who occupied our housing authority for 5 months. We have a $42 million headquarters. That Calvin Jeremiah came down from New York. It was a Bloomberg appointment under Mayor Nutter. And, you know, she started looking into things and they firebombed, you know, her house got firebombed and then they tried to take her children. So yeah, if you look closely at, it's huge money. And also if you control people's access to shelter, that and food are the primary means of controlling populations.
Right. Right. But so what you had was you had an increasingly expensive control model and there was no effort to end poverty. And what was amazing to me was even the not-for-profit leaders who said that they wanted to end poverty, if you really suggested or promoted an idea that would end poverty, they would get very threatened. And they literally saw their business as growing poverty. It was extraordinary.
The goal is not economic independence for working people or low-income people.
So,
and to me, the framework is the reservation system. I mean, if you go all the way back, it's the way in which we dispossessed Indigenous people and then put them on estate dependents and then, you know, made promises that were not kept, but controlling all of those things, you know, shelter, food.
Right. But it was a huge job program because you could create, if money was no object and there was no financial performance metric, you could just create more and more jobs of people messing and micromanaging other people. So, for example, say it again.
Like the job creation is at the administrative, the bureaucratic level, right? You're not talking about the people welfare to work.
Oh, no. We're talking about picking on them, watching them, giving them performance metrics. So one of my favorite stories was there was, because I've done a lot of looking at the food stamp program. There was a woman who lost her job during the financial crisis and I couldn't get another job, ultimately was forced to go on food stamps. And she had a problem and needed to call customer support. She called customer support and got a woman in India working for JP Morgan Chase. And she said, wait a minute, why are we paying somebody in JP Morgan, you know, in India to do a job I could do? And if I could do that job, I wouldn't need food stamps. So it doesn't pay to pay JP Morgan Chase to do a huge markup to do a job I could do. Now,
it's a skill market. That's
right,
their human
exactly.
impact investing.
Exactly. The same thing came out. I don't know if you've ever looked at the economics of private prison, but basically I got booted out of the establishment when I started to object to what they were doing, among other things, with private prisons. But essentially, they were paying $154,000 per year per person to run people through the prison system. And part of it was an entrapment on the drug dealing that basically they were controlling.
Right.
And so what you saw was you had one group who was above the law and another group who not only was not above the law, but was subject to endless entrapment and was part of an unbelievably expensive system to sort of manage them staying poor.
Exactly. And now right. Geo Group and CoreCivic are both moving into social work because they've got the technology now with the satellites and the geolocation, the digital ID to make the world a prison. So they don't right. so much need so many prisons. They're going to make all of the guards social workers. You know, that's the next business model. But the pathways are the same. Running them through the system is the same. They don't escape. Right. They're just, it's incarceration as opposed to physical confinement. And that's right. the nature of being in a standalone prison facility.
Right. So in 1994, the Department of Labor and my company did a joint venture where, on behalf of this wonderful group of pension fund leaders, we looked at ESG investing, among other things. And this was all part of digging down and looking at all the government money and trying to figure out what was going on in the economy. And where it all came out was there were two solutions. One was if you ran the government money according to the law, you know, which involves transparency and moving it to a positive return on investment, and you didn't give other people immunity to operate above the law, you could solve all the problems. You didn't.
That sounds like you wanted GAO. Yeah. Now.
But if you look at all the, you know, so I've watched you for the last 2 years unpacking all these incredible programs and financial schemes. And if you look at all that stuff, it's all a very complex bubble on top of something that is very simple theoretically to fix. In other words, you don't need to do anything to end poverty. You need to stop creating it. You need to stop doing the things that are creating it. So what we've got is this control system that's creating poverty hand over fist, and this growing bubble of people designed to manage and manipulate it. And when you look at that way, it's remarkably simple, even though, you know, the complexity in the bubble is beyond belief.
I have this one post. It says, to serve man is a cookbook. You know, it's the Twilight Zone episode. Wait, you know, with the aliens. So I've written translated it to serve man. It's actually a cookbook. Don't get on the UFO. I mean, and so I think the problem right now is that we have such profound wealth concentration, right? I mean, those are who are holding this enormous amounts of wealth, both in pension funds and sovereign wealth funds, in Bezos, is that they need stuff to throw their money at, right? And right. dispossessed people cannot run it on consumer model, and there's finite aspects of what the planet can hold in terms of throwaway consumption. So right. what do? They make a game, and this game is, I'm gonna put you on a nonprofit pathway and track you with a biosensor. And then us in the back room will bet on how you do on your path. It's not real, it's a fiction, but they get away with it.
Here's the little secret. The way they've built that wealth is by steadily lowering productivity, because you're building that wealth using the fiat currency system and immunity to the law. So you're doing things that destroy productivity. You're centralizing wealth, but you're controlling it in a way that destroys productivity. And that gives you a problem because you want to reinvest your wealth, but there's nothing productive to invest it in, right?
And well, so part of it is productivity, because I think for me, it's like a worldview. Because like the Japanese are imagining this high level of manufacturing automation, right? Like, oh, we've imagined that nurses through haptic robots in the Philippines can care for the elderly in Japan. And won't that be super efficient? Right.
Right.
And so it's like, who gets to decide what is productive? Like
right.
some of that is like cultural values. Do we actually want to outsource that in a way that on paper might look more productive, but is actually compromising the nature of life itself? And right. so there are these bigger existential questions.
Right. And it comes down to whether into it politically or economically, who gets to vote? And so if you look at what they're engineering, they're trying to take away an individual person's ability or right to vote, whether they're voting in the marketplace or they're voting in an election system. So let me go on this for one more thing, and then I want to come back and maybe we start with what's going on in Africa. If you look at the way the Western democracies have been run for the last couple decades, or the model, you have the central banks running monetary policy and the Treasury running fiscal policy. And in theory, the Treasury reports to the Congress and the electors vote for the Congress, and so they get a say about fiscal policy. So there's this balance of power between the fiscal and the central banks. What has been happening for the last two decades is we've had what I describe a financial coup, and now the central banks are moving in to control and operate fiscal policy and integrate it with monetary, so complete control. Now, their political problem is, how do they achieve taxation without representation? And I see your work as being very essential to understanding exactly how they plan to do that. Because what they're looking to do is move to traditional government functions being run by corporations and using technocracy to be able to extract all the benefits of new technology and all the benefits of any production by the general population. What they're saying is, we want 100% of the economic value, and we want 100% control. And we're going to use new technology to basically extract that. And this is how bankers can run the whole shebang and extract, you know, taxation without representation. That's what they're up to.
I mean, and I think it's important for people to understand that the shift to electronic government,
right?
The digital nations are part of that, Estonia being the model. And, you know, a lot of the Nordic structure there is this social safety net, right? Which feels like, well, yeah, people should, you know, have access. You know, we don't, you know, Philadelphia, I mean, you've been here, incredible, deep poverty.
Right.
And it's not
right.
because people are bad people are making bad choices. It's structural. And it has been for decades. And, you know, we're a city run by Democrats. And, you know, many politicians are people of color, too. And they're the ones who are running it for, you know, the poor. And we have huge problems. And so, like, we're not saying that we don't want people to have access to stable shelter, healthcare that meets their choices, you know, how they want to pursue healthcare, you know, those sorts of things. But what they're talking about is just putting algorithms, putting Oracle or Cisco or IBM or some computer system up in front of whoever you elect, because it will just be continuum, like what the markets want. They don't want to be interrupted by election cycles. They want to have a seamless mechanism running behind the scenes that you can just pop up whichever candidate in front, and they'll seem as though there's someone that you're accountable to. But it's even worse, because at this point it all becomes automated. And potentially, now that we're talking about decentralized autonomous organizations, like really automated and then potentially integrated with smart city sensor networks,
right?
Which are embedded within global policing systems and surveillance systems.
Well, they're talking about total control. So I don't know if you saw this presentation. I keep describing it. The IMF had a panel with Carstens and Powell. So Carstens is the general manager of the BIS, and Powell is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And Carstens mentions, oh, well, the beauty of CBDC is, if you don't want a foreign citizen transacting in your CBDC, you can just turn them off. Yeah. And of course, what that meant is you can turn all your citizens off one by one if you want to. Well, yeah. So Powell is like backing up and saying, oh, don't mention that.
Right. But it's all running on the telecoms. It's the SIM cards in your cell phone.
Those, right.
You know, and they've got sniffer drones. They'll just, are you somewhere you're not supposed to be? Whoop,
right.
Got that information. We'll just make it impossible, you know. And I think it's so challenging, is that we're so highly partisan right now, and that is on purpose, that is by design. That when I went into the Dirksen Senate building and I saw them talking about the Social Impact Partnerships Pay for Results Act, which was the seed money to roll out these human capital bond markets in the opportunity zones that you know so much about.
And right.
You know, it was all, the speakers were all elected Republican, representatives, but the panelists were all Obama policy wonks and Goldman Sachs.
Right.
And then the room
right.
of 200 people was all nonprofits. And, you know, there was just like me and the person we came with were the only people outside of this system. And
right.
so you're looking around thinking this whole structure, and most people are oblivious that it's even bad. You know, and that's part of the narrative, and I'm just cautious because, yes, incredible corruption, like I've seen it here, but their antidote, because it's always problem solution, right? We will be super transparent. We will be super accountable. We will be super hands-off because it's all automated. And then that's where you run into the thing where they're going to put your government on blockchain.
So
how do we navigate those things? It's hard.
So it is very hard. But first, I think we have to help people You know, sort of they're trying to build the different train tracks before they throw the trap. One of the great things about the interview you just did, what's the name of the host?
Zakiya.
Oh, she's fabulous. She says something about, we're innovating our own prison. I'm constantly complaining. We're building our own prison. But it was beautiful. She said, we're innovating, you know, into our own prison. Anyway, so there was one other thing I wanted to go into before we, so I see this as being relatively simple, which is you have a group of people who control the creation of money and credit. And there is no reason that we need a monopoly on the creation of money and credit centrally. You know, that's what needs to be decentralized. And it's part of what gives them the power to implement massive secrecy. I mean, they can just print money. So to a certain extent, what we've got is a debate between the people who can print money and the people who have to earn a living.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about credit, though, that's so different with moving into this blockchain world, right, is that I've seen, you know, because I'm sort of politically homeless. Like, I came at things more from the left, right? And then I'm like, what the hell? Heck, it happened to all y'all?
Where'd the left go?
You know, and then within this framework. So I don't know, like, at this point, I'm sort of, you know, anarchist, whatever. But, like, the libertarian side, I said, you know, there are papers out there. There's one in Idaho that's circulating where they're sort of like, get the government out of our business. We'll just run it on blockchain. This is our answer. Right. And they're talking about investments of, like, community funds. And I know you've talked about that somewhat. But that, like, churches and will invest on blockchain in people. Right. And so what I've tried to do in going out to Salt Lake City, because these faith institutions are central both to the nonprofit service delivery, and then they also are very, very powerful in their endowment, you know, and clearly the Vatican just had their health conference and they've been having impact investing conferences since 2014. What does it mean if you somehow reset it so it's not the central banks? I'm no fan of the central banks, but all of a sudden it's the Vatican and the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund and, like, the Latter-day Saints Church that are doing the blockchain token investing in humanity. And what I've gone to say is, because all of this has been set up through the Poor People's Campaign and Reverend Barber, which is coming out of the Caro Center at Union Theological Seminary and is funded by the Ford Foundation, which we know, I'm like, the Ford Foundation is not funding a revolutionary poor people's movement, folks.
Right.
You know, it is market shaping for impact. Right. What does it mean to be a person of faith, whatever that faith practice is, or access to your own private, you know, maybe it's not a faith person, maybe it's an individually wealthy individual, of making an investment in another human being where the impact metrics or their compliance to the agreed upon contract, because this is all running on contract law, are tied into this panopticon, which, by the way, has, like, wireless, you know, the EMF radiation that's going to kill us all in the long run and turn us into, like, jelly, and then we have to live as cartoon characters in a video game. So, like, there are these big things. I'm talking to churches and saying, is this what you really want to do? Because I don't think you want to put poor kids on a surveillance play table and call it a day and say that you've done your good for humanity.
Right.
Because that's also a problem.
Right. Because blockchain is easily engineered into a slavery system.
Totally. It's going to run. Yeah, the spatial web.
Right. And it's also a blockchain in a world where there's a one-way mirror. So one group has no privacy and the other group is invisible. You know, so you have a huge, when it comes to information and intelligence, you've got an unbelievable imbalance in the balance of power. So let me mention one other thing that I want to combine with what you're saying about the blockchain. We have the old system where an investor buys a treasury bond, earns currently approximately 1%, and it goes to finance poverty management. Yeah. In the human impact bond, the investor gets 10%, and it goes to finance poverty management growth.
Wow.
Okay. Why do we need to give the investor, you know, 1,000% more return to do something funded by government, which government has been doing? You know, if government wants to have a performance contract, it can engineer one at 1%. It doesn't have to pay 10 times as much. But we have all this complex packaging.
Let's see, that we can empire. I think that's the thing. Like, in the United States, I don't think we're considering ourselves as being, like, in the belly of the beast of empire. I mean, that's my positioning. And I've spent some time like looking into like the papal bulls and the doctrine of discovery, like ultimately right. there is this heritage of those in power wielding this power in legal structures that are never meant to share equitably. It's not like there's not a culture of reciprocity largely in how it's a bootstrap country, which has a lot of the independence. And I'm not saying like, I certainly don't want like blockchain socialism or anything, but there is an imbalance of power so that just continues to magnify up the chain. And that's my take.
Right. But here, how do I say this? We're coming into an inflection point where their goal is to reduce hundreds of millions of people to poverty.
Yeah.
And they need a way to engineer that, and they need a way to manage it. That's what they're trying to do, is come up with a model, because remember, they're using our taxes and our retirement savings to engineer it.
Yeah. Right. We're paying to build this prison.
Right. Yeah. So we're paying to build it. We're building it. You know, we go to work and we help them build it. But if you look at the economics of what they're doing, because most of the money that's being spent to build this has been accessed illegally through governments. So their management of the government resources has been criminal, and there are massive violations of the law. And the model they're using in terms of where they're going with the existing and the future financial systems, you know, it depends on our resources to engineer this. And that's one of their weak spots. And if you look at the recent discussion by the central bankers, they're very afraid of people figuring out that they are creating inequality, and it's intentional, and we're financing it.
Right. I mean, I think up to this point, if we could find an effective way, and it's such a challenge to distill it down,
right.
But the people who are standing on the side of, you know, health, freedom, natural rights, you know, people to have autonomy over what happens to their bodies and their livelihoods, to understand that what is unfolding is beyond the medical passport system, and is, you know, and you've speaking of the digital right. slavery, but that it is specifically the element of the weaponized social safety net under this, combined with the automation and the panopticon and the robotic shift. Because I find there's not a lot of people out there right now who are making connections between what we were saying, like putting the children in Ethiopia on blockchain for education and the Israel's green passport that is tied right. to a medical. But fundamentally, the technology is the same and their end goal is going to be the same.
So we're going to figure out how to do that today.
Okay, good.
I don't know how we're going to do it, but I know we're going to do it.
Because that would be incredibly powerful, because there are many, yes. many motivated people, but they don't have the larger schema.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the obstacles to getting the larger schema, and this is one of the reasons I loved your recent interview, and again, we'll put the link up, was when the host says, and I told you, I thought this was the best description I've ever heard of the system. She says, you know, this is some sick shit. You know, and I don't like to use four-letter words on this lawyer report, but she nailed it. It was so funny. I just cracked up. And, you know,
well, I think, again, if you are someone who has come out of this legacy of understanding the dispossession, like, and that's the thing, most of the people running the bureaucracy either are coming from places of not necessarily having direct experience, or else having lived through it and gotten the golden ring and been anointed to the managerial class to run it. So
right.
all of the people running the machine are incredibly disincentivized to actually deal with the cognitive dissonance of the harm that they're doing. They
right.
just want to really believe that what they're doing is helping,
right.
and it isn't. And it's increasingly right. not going to help as we start, you know, mixing it up with biosensors and drones, you know.
So when I used to work with the bureaucracy at HUD, whenever they would bump into the wall where they had to start to face, you know, the real goals of the program, they would back off and instead make it more complicated. and the sort of the way of avoiding the, you know, the incoherence or facing the incoherence was to just make things more complicated. And I think one of the reasons it's hard to unpack this is it's so complicated. Okay, so here's on one side we've got the central bankers, and on one side, we've got individual humans. you know, so call them citizens, call them taxpayers, and they have a completely different vision of, you know, one has a vision of a human civilization and the other has a vision of livestock management or a slavery system. They're different ways of describing it. And I think, you know, step number one is to face the fact that the visions are so completely, you know, we're sitting here in a very win-lose position. Now, I will tell you that if you've ever studied the slave trade, I believe one of the reasons they canceled it was they couldn't find a way of perfecting collateral. So if you were a bank in London, you financed a group of 100 slaves for a plantation owner at a 50% loan to value ratio, and the commodities market went down and the plantation owner sold them west, you had no way of identifying that Harry and Sally were really your slaves and getting them back. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now with digital technology, you can.
Yeah.
And because you can, I think there is nothing more dangerous than the blockchain. You know, the idea that the blockchain, there are certain things that should not be managed or optimized with price. And to put living things on a blockchain, to me, is exceptionally dangerous.
Well, and the one thing too that I want to encourage people to look into about blockchain, because I think the focus is very much around like the currency aspect, you know, and the finance, but it's ultimately a ledger system
right.
that holds currency, but it holds much more. And their idea is like your e-government is to run really your rights and privileges. And you, it is a token economy that I sort of describe as like living your life in a mother may I game.
Right.
And the yes, you may means that you have this token. And the token is something you've earned either through some work, which there will be less and less of, or behavior or compliance behavior on a pathway or within this larger, you know, medical establishment regime that is coming online. So the spatial web, which is coming, will run on blockchain and it will be contract law. So right now, the major players in this space are the accounting firms. It's the KPMG, the Deloitte, the Accenture. They're the ones setting the terms of this game because they're overlaying contracts, micro contracts right. onto everything that, with the sensors. And that's something I think is not in most people's realm of experience, that the way in which you engage with the physical world will be mediated by these tokens. And acquisition of the tokens will be determined by performing according to this global
right. regime. And where they're free to extract as much as they want in taxes whenever they want. In other words,
and I think some of it's going to be piezoelectric energy too. I think some right. of it is actually going to be like, here's your smart mirror, run. You know, here's your smart gym in your house, power right. the smart grid.
Right. So, but I get back to a double standard, because you're talking about one group that's subject to rules and laws, and another group that is free to use that system to extract, but is not subject to the same rules and laws.
Well, it's very arbitrary, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I would sort of say that it's kind of been that way since the beginning, but you know, you only get the benefit of the law if you can take it to the Supreme Court and you have those resources. So for most
right.
average people, the laws have always been pretty arbitrary.
Yeah. Right, I always thought they were pretty arbitrary. I spent 11 years litigating with the federal government. And you're right, you have to spend a great deal of money and time. But I was surprised at how many people in the system really believe in the Constitution and the laws and what a difference that makes. Now, much of that is cultural, but, you know, it's almost a cultural covenant, and it protects a lot of people from a lot of things. So mm-hmm. I grew up in 48th and Larchwood,
yeah.
you know, and I saw a lot of the shenanigans go on. You know, but I see, having traveled a lot in third world countries, the cultural commitment to the law has made a huge difference. And as that cultural commitment goes away, things are getting much worse.
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, it's sort of a balance. I'm not here to say like I would want to throw it all out, but I think situating it, for me, my sort of epiphany from the education angle was
right.
connected to seeing what happened at Standing Rock. and their treaty stands over their land, and seeing that disregard, especially Regina Brave, that the structure has always been built on an economic model in which some people were disposable and some people needed to go away, right, to make the new model work. And so if we understand that this new economic model is global in nature and that runs on the technology and that anticipates largely moving what we call natural life into some cybernetic synthetic abomination of itself, that this sort of settler colonial mindset for me is sort of where I picture it. Like, yeah, now those laws are just going to be set aside, which doesn't mean we shouldn't fight with them, but we should understand it with that larger framework.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Africa, because what you're seeing is the systems that they want to use, they're prototyping in a variety of different places.
Right.
And one of the reasons we don't connect the dots is they're prototyping this over there. They're prototyping this over here. You did a very good job in your last interview of describing how the, you know, the different pieces all over the place, so you can't kind of bring them together. So talk about what's going on in, it's in Ethiopia, correct?
Right. Yeah. So this is, again, you know, we're sort of at this point. You know, I will say, I don't believe that necessarily all of the potential terrible things are going to all manifest, right? Like, I think there is a fair amount of overreach here, and there's a lot of moving parts, and I'm not at all confident, especially when I see some of these, that they can pull it off. So I'm saying this all with the understanding is this is how they talk about it,
right?
And that we should pay attention, because these are people who are controlling some of the, you know, militaries and money and other things. It's just not worth putting it aside and saying it probably won't happen. We need to actually know what they're thinking. So Cardano is deploying the largest program of digital identity, government-backed digital identity in the world right now. And so that was about 3 weeks ago. They rolled out, they have an agreement with the Ministry of Education in Ethiopia. And Ethiopia is, they have in Addis Ababa something called the Sheba Valley, which is sort of the Silicon Valley of the continent of Africa. And so a lot of their high-tech development is happening there. And the Ethiopian Ministry of Education has ties to the British Council. Some of these education programs that they're advancing will be technology-based, because all of the, you know, transparency and accountability has to be tracked on blockchain as data. So there are ties in with the Center for Universal Education, with the Council on Foreign Relations, right? In Addis Ababa in 2015, Tedros Ghebreyesus was hosted the finance committee for the UN Sustainable Development Goals.
Right.
So they adopted those in 2015, and then they brought the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization there to figure out how do we run the money for these deals, which is essentially the rules of this game, this transhumanist hedge fund game that they're calling green and, you know, solving poverty. How do we finance it? So that happened.
So in Ethiopia. So I just have to tell you, forever I'm going to think of this, instead of financing poverty at 1%, how can we finance it at 10% and get government to pay for it?
Exactly. And then you have Jim Heckman saying, you know how we can do that? We can brainwash toddlers on, you know, with virtual reality and video games. I mean, literally, that's how they're setting it up. And everyone's just saying, oh, we love social emotional learning, you know, because nobody has all the pieces. But so they've got this 500, they plan to put 5 million students and teachers on blockchain. And this is not because, I mean, actually, there is a 2-minute clip with Hoskinson, who's the head of Cardano, saying essentially the metadata of all of your digital interactions in the education space will accrue over the course of your life in alignment with the government. So, you know, it's public-private partnership, aligning with the government, deciding who is a good actor, like who is a good actor according to government standards, and then to actually decide who should be allowed to have a job. And that was sort of the end of the clip. He's saying, so this metadata from your childhood, potentially your pre-K experience, will be tracked, granular level data, not only of you, but all of your interactions with your peers and your teachers and computer programs, to decide if you can be trusted to even have a job.
Is there any discussion of the fact that you cannot be deleted from the blockchain?
Well, so I have a colleague that who is the chair of the education committee of the NAACP in San Jose. And she actually presented and was approved at the 2019 meeting in Detroit of the NAACP national meeting to a resolution opposing linking blockchain identity to social benefit systems. To say, like, and part of that was, you know, this was 2 or 3 years ago when she was in meetings hearing, well, we're going to track lettuce, you know, on the blockchain. Now we're hearing it a lot now. So we know if there's an outbreak, which field it came from. And she said, well, you know, but then the lettuce falls off the truck, you know, and gets a little dinged, and then that's tracked. Well, that's one thing if it's lettuce. It's another thing if it's a child. And it's another thing if knowing that these markets in social impact management run on trauma and poverty. So you're going to manufacture harm so you can fix it to make the return. You right. don't put people on blockchain. And because it is a permanent record, and some of the data can be bad, wrong, incorrect. Right. So nobody's really talking about it. It's all being framed as liberation. Here we are going, you know, ever since I saw there was a video clip of Richard Branson at Necker Island when he brought all of the blockchain people in, and they're all going to solve global poverty and boot, you know, boot the global unbanked, you know, into the, you know, digital capitalism. And that's what happened in India. That's why they had their currency reset. That's why they have Aadhaar. That's why they're being targeted right. for this takeover.
Right. Right.
This is not liberation. This right. this thing that they're building is not liberation. So anyway, so that's in place. But it's important to know that in Africa, you know, I frame it as it's a military technology. The cloud is a military right. technology. Right. And it runs on
the internet is a military technology.
Especially that, yeah, all the cloud computing is. And it runs on minerals, extractive resources that harm the natural environment beyond what happens to human beings. You know, the child labor in Congo and the issues with, you know, the cobalt that is mined there. This is not a future. Creating a digitally twinned future does not come without really profound human costs and environmental costs. So the piece about Cardano, and it's actually being run through something called IOHK, Inputs Outputs Hong Kong. So again, treating people like you know, it's total Taylorism, which again is Philadelphia, right? Friedrich Taylor, right? What is our social efficiency, you know, our mechanization on the right. assembly line, only we're being assembled. In the inputs, outputs, that's based in Hong Kong. And, you know, they've set it up with labs in Edinburgh, Scotland, and Wyoming, actually. Right. They have these blockchain labs. But they're partnered with Ben Gertzel, who is with Hanson Robotics. So Hanson Robotics, who created Sophia the robot, the humanoid robot that's now a citizen of Saudi Arabia, they have a lab in the Sheba Valley called ICOG's lab. ICOG's lab is under something called OpenCog, which is the AI neuroscience software they're using to try to build these humanoid robot brains, which right. was originally backed in 2013 by Jeffrey Epstein. Right. So it goes way, like, so there are these things where they're actually beyond putting the children on blockchain and surveilling them as data, beyond the hedge fund markets and human capital that will be applied to those children and managing them for a precarious global gig economy with haptic robotics, they're actually going to be feeding those kids data. I can't be sure, but I can't imagine any other reason they would be creating it into the singularity net, which is what Gertzel has set up. To try to trigger the singularity, to generate all of the impact data from the sensor networks to teach the machines to be people, to teach the machines to be natural beings.
So let me step back and integrate with the economics. If you look at the learning power of AI, the interesting thing about AI is the guy with the best AI is not the guy with the best software developers. It's the guy with the most data. Right. Yeah. So we're watching a vampire-like sucking sound of various groups of people trying to get as much data as possible. Yeah. So, you know, so the surveillance is getting beyond invasive and deep because they're trying to digitize everything because they're trying to suck up the data and be the winner in the AI war. And what you're describing is, you know, I liken it to outsourcing your job to India. If you can get the human race on software and AI and hooked up to the cloud, then you can get the human race to teach the robots how to do the human jobs.
And that's what it unfolds, because so MIT developed something called Affectiva a while ago under, you know, it's all dual use. Oh, we care about kids on the spectrum. We want to give them social cues and whatever. And so it's emotion sensing software for the screens. And most people don't know. I mean, we're getting more and more, but this was 3 or 4 years ago. And they're trying to capture all of our internal life, our soul and our spirit into this thing, because it's one thing to give them just raw information. It's another to teach them to be human. So in the education space, for quite a few years, they focused on social emotional learning. And that's coming out of the Novo Foundation, which is Peter Buffett, which is Warren Buffett's son. So they're intent on not only capturing the minds of the children, but mining them for their behavioral data to train up the robots. And Sophia, like I have this clip, she says, I want to learn to have empathy. Now the UN is saying they're putting virtual reality headsets on people and they call them empathy machines to say, look here, you can imagine being in a refugee camp. And then they will measure your behavior change in your biometrics to say, oh, see, we've made them more empathetic to the refugees and fulfill an impact, social impact deal. But then you've pulled the emotional data out of the person in this traumatic situation and thrown it over to the robots. And so there's all of these layers of understanding that you just have to stick with it because it just builds.
Right. So one of the things I have believed is that if you look at bringing in robotics, if you had to create a different legal system to manage your robots, it would take many decades longer to implement robotics. But if you can change the definitions of human and how you manage the humans to integrate robotics into the same labor force and you have one legal system for both, Allison, I can't describe to you how much money you can save and the speed at which you can operate. And I think a lot of the crazy transgender, you know, things like the different, you know, complex sexes and what, by de-sexing the humans, you can integrate the robots and go much faster as a legal matter. And
so there's a lot of framework around equity too. So I don't know if you've seen the Moonshot paper. So the Japan Science and Technology Agency, like they've advanced that by 2050, we're supposed to operate without a physical body and mind in space. Like, and you know, that's Nippon Telegraph and Telephone and that's SoftBank and the Saudi, you know, money, their innovation fund. So that's nothing to sneeze at if they're throwing this out there. Who knows that they can get there, but that's that they're imagining and they're framing it as equity and diversity. And also like the neural equity, like neurodiversity too, which is again, not to say that people shouldn't all be able to be cherished as human beings, like with where they are, but if they can create the equity, diversity, inclusion narrative to include robots, right, that we should not, to include cybernetics, to include, you know, human hybrids. You're right. That's a very good point about the legal jurisdiction. We don't even know right now if we might be cybernetic given the nanorobotics. Like
it's much easier if you can change our status to non-person and have everything from a pure human to a cyborg to a robot in the same system, it gets much easier from a legal standpoint. So, and the taxation, remember the whole taxation system works, you know, very much off the labor system. So this gets back to your taxation without representation. I've had billionaire venture capitalists basically explain to me, look, we're not going to use humans anymore. We're going to do everything with AI software and robotics. We don't need humans anymore.
But I think they're trying to use the human. Well, one, it's the impact markets, but I think they're trying to use them both to power this new system, to catalyze this new transhumanism.
Well, I would say this, they're planning, they're not sure exactly which way it's going to go. And they're going to manage the process into robotics so that the humans teach the robots and they optimize within the system. In other words, they're going to prototype pure robots versus cyborgs versus humans, you know, what's better for what. They're optimizers, so they want as much juice out of it as possible. But one of the things they know, given technology, they think they can basically engineer all the humans, with rare exception, into a poverty status where they have complete control, and that gives them the ability to extract all the wealth and radically increase their life expectancy without it you know, making a mess in the general population. So they're looking for complete control.
No, and, I know. I mean, I keep trying to think, do they imagine that they're out of the system? I mean, they bought their island or their wilderness preserve and they're not, you know, because even within the weaponized weather and I mean, like, unless you're going to live underground somewhere, like, I just don't see how they think that they're going to be totally out of it, because they're weaponizing the entire atmosphere. Like, that's.
So to a certain extent, I think part of it is the technology is a little bit out of control. But the other thing is, these are people who, you know, they have a lot to fear at this point. They're very afraid of the general population. So let me give you a perfect example. So I've spent a lot of time tracking money missing from the U.S. government and violations of the law and the financial management. So you mentioned David Rubenstein and the Council for Foreign Relations. If you look at the $21 trillion that went missing from fiscal 1998 to fiscal 2015, and now it's up to $100 trillion, believe it or not. So, you know, the players who ran the Council on Foreign Relations, their institutions, their banks, and the Carlyle Group, you know, certainly the banks, but it appears the Carlyle Group as well, were intimately involved in shifting that money.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if one set of players gets to steal $21 trillion from the other set of players, that's an enormous advantage. And you have a lot to be afraid of, because when you start pulling pension funds or retirement benefits on people, they might want their money back, because it's documented, okay? And it's documented who the banks were. And under the law, the New York Fed and its member banks have legal responsibility for any illegal transactions and any cost to the citizens of those illegal transactions. So there's tremendous legal liability here if people start to connect the dots and act.
And well, I guess part of it, I think, within this transhumanist shift and framing what has unfolded as, you know, a national security threat around health, you know, pandemic, recurrent ongoing pandemic, is that if you try to assert one's own rights and choice about how you control your body, then you become framed as an enemy of the state, right? And so increasingly people will start to realize, like, as more and more of these happen, to wait a minute, my rights are being compromised. My ability, especially as the spatial web happens, as the QR codes, you know, if, you know, they're toying with this right now, but it will start to get tighter and tighter, and then more people will push back. But then I think the level of incarceration of digital control system, of punitive, can be reframed. So then you don't really have access to the courts if you've been framed, you know, in the way that they like to frame people. And so it's this balancing act for them. And I think the fact that we don't have, part of it is telling the right story, I think.
Yes.
How do we create a narrative that allows this to make sense, something that by all rights shouldn't make sense, to allow people to get their mind that there are powerful people who imagine humans as livestock, who hold uncontrollable amounts of power that goes back centuries, who are enacting something that seems almost unfathomable, but that in that seeing it, we could unify to stand against it, right? That it is a house hard somewhat, if we actually could have the wherewithal to look at it in a unified manner.
Right.
And to me, understanding, you know, I've done a lot of looking into Stephen Newcomb's work around this doctrine of discovery, but domination, right? Nobody wants to be dominated, right? There is this system of domination that has happened, like through the Roman Empire, you know, to Europe, to the Celts, to the indigenous people of Turtle Island, to Africa. There's this nature of domination, and they're targeting children. They're targeting the unborn. They're targeting reproduction of natural life, not just of humans. That's a unifier.
Right.
To me, like, if you can position this as a sacred engagement, no matter, that crosses faith, that crosses geography, that crosses nationalism, that we stand for life, for the perpetuation of non-synthetic life on this planet against a dominating force of sociopathic finance military, you know, mad scientists, that's a profound narrative that people could get behind.
Right.
Right. And then in the aftermath, we have to figure out how to do it better, because clearly, however we had, like, you know, I think we may have different positions on this. I feel like we're here because of a logical continuum of where we started, as opposed to it being an aberration, but we can work that out. But in this moment, I think to look at the history.
I don't think this is an aberration. I think we've had, you know, we've been governed for 500 years by a central banking warfare model.
Okay.
And more or less, we're all complicit one way or another in that model. Yeah. But at the top of that model, which is a big mystery, you know, I call the committee that runs the world Mr. Global, but it's still a big mystery. You have people who believe project. What?
That's my answer. The Impact Management Project.
But you have people who believe in slavery, and they do view management of the general population as livestock. So, and they are not, you know, there is enough documentation of the history of genocide to know, you know, genocide has been with us for centuries, and it you know, it rises and slows down and ebbs, but we have every reason to believe we're staring down the barrel of a serious genocide effort here. Yeah. So, but I think you're right. We've got to come to a story, not just of what's going on, but what could be. And to me, this comes down to, do we want to be humans who resonate with each other and all living beings, or do we want to be, you know, captured and resonating with a machine controlled by some invisible force?
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Now, as a financial person, I also believe that means the humans are going to have to take back the monopoly on managing and running the financial system, because one of the reasons we got here is the financial system is extracting a greater and greater portion of the economy in a way that is destructive of life, it's destructive of the environment, it's destructive of the human race, and it's leading us into a completely psychopathic place.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I mean, I think, and it's the debt finance piece that some, and I think on the left, they keep saying like, oh, you know, capitalism is falling apart. You know, it's reached this point. This is, and I'm like, no, it's been virtualized. I mean, it's going to be virtual commodities. It's going to be digital commodities. They're going to commoditize behaviors and securitize behavioral compliance. And that's what the blockchain is going to run.
Well, but if you look at the people who lead this, I mean, this is not an important point, but the people who believe this don't believe in capitalism. They've never practiced capitalism. You know, the New York Fed member banks practice monopoly, and they practice immunity to the law as a legal doctrine in this country. And if you look at, they practice criminal enterprise. Organized crime is not capitalism. There's a difference. And so these people don't believe in capitalism.
Well, I think it's the domination. And this domination crosses the banking. I truly believe that also what's coming, given the poverty nature of this and also the spiritual nature, is most faith institutions at the top have been hijacked into this program.
Absolutely.
Like, it's not straight up running it, but they're enmeshed. They're deeply enmeshed. Right. This is not individuals of faith, but this is the institutions.
Right.
And I feel like that it's very likely they're going to blockchain religion. You know, they'll start to blockchain faith tenets, and it'll be integrated with the smart grid. Yeah. And like, you know, sorry to you if, you know, you have a different faith practice and the only slot for your shelter that night is Catholic. That's what you got. You got to obey the Catholic blockchain, you know, because sorry, that's what it is. And, you know, a lot of that's coming out of Philly. I mean, it goes way back. You know,
well, Philly's always been,
but the housing is running out of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, no, in the scheme of sort of running the world in the United States, the U.S. version, Philly was always very, very powerful, both in organized crime and on the Mason side. So
I know.
Yeah. Now, when I grew up in Philly, there was the Vatican, you know, and the Archdiocese was huge, and they controlled the unions, and they controlled, you know, so they had the unions, they had the truckers, they had transportation, they had some of the cops. Then the Masons controlled the banks and the law firms, so they kind of controlled city halls, although the Vatican was making inroads. And then the Jews were smaller, but they sort of outpunched their weight. So they were major players. And it's been very interesting, because what it looked like in Philadelphia is that the Jews and the Masons really teamed up, got control of telecommunications, worked very closely with the intelligence agencies, and have tried to power shift the Vatican. So if you look at how the NSA, you know, replaced the confession box, mm-hmm. I mean, think of it. The Vatican depended on storefront churches to get their control files, right?
Mm.
Right. So they got outpunched by the telecom guys. So if you notice, the chairman of the University of Pennsylvania Board of Overseers is from
Oh
Comcast.
yeah, no, I know, I
Right.
know. Well, and
Right.
the thing is, like, he and Judith Rodin were, it came through the healthcare system, right? And I would see the rising buildings at the Penn Health Campus, right? The research, and I kept thinking, for the past 10 years, more and more buildings, more and more buildings, and I kept thinking, they're thinking we're going to be really sick. Like you can see where the money is, right? When, in terms of what gets
Right.
built. So it's Comcast, the two giant towers, they're going to run our life through their towers. And then this medical complex. And I didn't really, it wasn't until the past maybe 8 months that I realized they don't actually think we're going to be sick. They're going to process us into cybernetic, some sort of synthetic life version of ourselves.
So I used to drive all over the United States, so I would always try and drive and not fly. And one of the things I noticed coming into the financial crisis is they started to build out two huge complexes in every community. And you really see it when you drive through the rural. One was the criminal complex, the criminal justice center. And that's where you process people out through the illegal drugs. And then they built up the hospitals and the big doctor complexes. But in all the Kroger's, Walmart, Target, the floor space for pharmaceuticals was suddenly radically shifted up. And I realized, oh, they're going to process the middle class out through the pharmacies and the hospitals and the poor people out, but it's both a pharma model. In other words, if you look at the line of what's legal and illegal, it's very carefully managed to optimize the liquidation of both populations.
That's interesting. Well, and I mentioned before, so my father, he spent his career, he was a Procter and Gamble executive. He sold Folgers coffee. He was like a
Really?
working guy who, was in the right place. He worked in grocery stores and he got into a job that he did very well. And he never went to Cincinnati, but he, that's how I in corporate suburbia was Procter & Gamble. And he would go and he would like look for people, like, what coffee do you have in your cabinet? Do you have Charmin? Like, and so I knew all of the products. And this is sort of the consumer model, right? The consumer. And
Right.
also they were really good at supply chain management and leading edge globalization. And also advertising and media consumption, right? And the entertainment, right? The soap operas, right? That was all Procter and Gamble. Well, they developed the RFID chip technology, which they
Right,
spun out
that's
to
true.
IT, the Auto ID Lab. And like there's some story, it was a sales rep who was tracking a lipstick. He was the Oil of Olay sales rep or something. And as my father like reached retirement, it shifted from Jif peanut butter and Folgers coffee and these different things into pharma. It was health and beauty. The
Right.
whole thing pivoted into health and beauty. And then, I real like in realizing this shift, in retrospect, you look back and you think, oh, you're actually not going to get to, your food consumption is going to be replaced by your pharmaceutical consumption. And the
Right.
pharmaceutical consumption is almost like, we're post-Fordist, right? The assembly line is moving, and instead of cars on the assembly line, it's people, and the nonprofits and the medical interventions are the things on the side managing them. And then the
Right.
hedge funds are betting on how that gets completed. But it's not a mindset most people have, right? They're thinking that the economy is even the level of globalization that's coming. Who's talking about haptic robotics? Not
Right.
many people.
Right. So part of it is if you look at how these things are engineered, they're engineered way ahead.
Yeah.
So you're watching things being engineered and packaged and market that are going to have dramatic consequences 5, 10, 20 years. So I'll give you a perfect example. In when was it? In the 90s, I started to notice that the United States airports were being relaid out to have very large, essentially shopping malls.
Yeah.
And I thought, how are they going to get people to come to the airport to shop? They're planning on people spending hours at the airport ahead of their flight. How are they going to engineer that? And that went on from about 96 through
And they're high-end
2001.
shops. They're
What?
kind of high-end shops. They're reasonably high-end.
Right. But then 9/11 happened, and then they changed the rules where you had to spend 2 hours at the airport before your flight. But they knew in 1996 to build those shopping malls into the airport 6 years ahead.
And the same with like Philadelphia is taking out their seating in the waiting areas and putting like much lower density, high top tables with iPads in all of them.
Really?
And that happened. Yeah. And they had self-serve cash, card only food pickup, just finished it like 3 months before the pandemic happened. So they like people on the inside track know what's coming.
Right. So, well, when I was on Wall Street, the partners would gather on the first week of January for the strategic planning, and the chairman would come in and he'd say, let me tell you what's going to happen this year. And he'd lay it all out.
I just wonder, are they really good actors, or are they able to just channel their brain into a different reality? Like when they turn it on, they just imagine a different reality and they tell that's the thing. Cause I can't imagine they're all that good at acting, like holding up the narrative.
So you see this, it's complicated. Some people are great at lying. You know, it depends on how high up you are and where you are. Some people have trained to believe that the general population wants what I call the story of I am good, that they want to lie and you're giving them what they want. So there's an official reality and there's reality, and it's okay to play the game because that's what everybody wants. You know, so part of it is that. Some of them just are, you know, they're great. I don't know if you'd call them psychopaths or sociopaths, but they make money from lying. It's a big business. It's really profitable and they're running organized crime. So they, you know, they're fine. But what is amazing, Allison, is how many people there are in the system who really believe that what they're doing in their little niche is good, and they don't connect the dots. And it's frightening to me how many of them there are. Now, when I go through your material and I go through the program like Ethiopia or the role of crypto in various things or the blockchain, and you look at all the different groups that are building the prison, as I would call it, you know, they are going around in circles in what I call pretzel talk. You know, they have all this chipper happy reasons why what they're doing is innovative and important and is going to help people. And, you know, the marketing is endless. It's unbelievable. And, but they, you know, they don't understand what they're doing in the whole scheme of things. And so the question is, if they perceive that their pet treats are going to come by being, you know, feeding all this language back, this chipper language back, the question is, can they come out of it? It's almost like a trance.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, as things get worse, then you realize you're implicated, right?
Right.
Like if you've been participating, and then that's a lot of trauma in and of itself to both
right.
own up, even if maybe you didn't fully appreciate what you were a part of, right? Like, you know, I went to college, my dad sold Folgers coffee. Did I really think much? Like, I was a kid. I wasn't thinking about Central America, like Latin American
right.
policy and what coffee commodities meant.
Right.
But now I do, like, I know better. And so like, how do you go back and within sort of, if you understand this is a spiritual reckoning, which I sort of feel like that this is an energetic.
Yes.
It's not just money. I mean, because they say, well, why would you do that? All these people have more money than they could ever spend. It's this idea of changing, playing God. These people who have all of this power are literally looking to recreate the nature of life itself into something that they can control and own and patent and manage and eliminate if they so choose. And
right.
so it is a spiritual thing. So there's lots of back packaging that we all have to come out of to sort of figure out where do we fit into this machine? Because I think, you know, I've had people tell me in the past, well, you know, you have this, that, or the other connection, so you shouldn't be saying anything because you're part of it too. And I'm like, I know I'm part of
it.
No,
We're all part of it.
We can't back out of it. We have to look at it.
Right. It's like a tapestry. And the money, you know, it's like when you pour dirty, if I were to pour red dye into a swimming pool, it would take no time till it's everywhere. And it's the same with the dirty money. The dirty money pours in, it goes everywhere. We're all part of it. So, one of the most positive things I ever read, I'm a great fan of John Rappaport, who does these interviews. For years, he did interviews with insiders. And one of the guys he interviewed was a very senior PR person. And my interpretation of what this guy said is he probably did special projects for the Council on Foreign Relations Executive Committee, is my guess. And his job was to do the big, big lies, the big propaganda. And the pseudonym John gave him, he started to talk to John after he had retired. And the pseudonym John gave him was Ellis Medavoy. Now, have you ever read the Ellis Medavoy interviews?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to arrange for you to get a copy of the Ellis Medavoy interviews. Anyway, so John does a couple of interviews with Ellis, and finally he gets very frustrated, and he said, look, if we're so stupid and we're so easy to trick, why are you even bothering to talk to me? And Ellis says, and these are my words, I don't remember his exact words, he says, you know, every time we thought we had it completely nailed and controlled, there would be this, like, thing, and it would be just out of our control. And what he's describing, I would describe as the divine intelligence. And I would see it all the time when I was on Wall Street, because I did big market deals. And just when I was sure I knew exactly how it would go and what was going to happen, you know, and this is why I love markets where they're appropriate, wham, something would come out of left field and things would just, and you realize, you know, no one is as smart as all of us. And it's amazing when all of us participate, what comes out. And the problem with that, the reason Mr. Global doesn't like that, is you can't predict who's going to end up in control or on top. It's just, you know, it's out of control. But yeah, it's unbelievably lovely. And that's why, to me, it's so important we all resonate with life. Because that thing, whatever that thing is, that's where the magic, you know, to me, that's where the juice of freedom and liberty and life come from. Anyway, but what Ellis described was it was impossible to put it into a box. And so my narrative is that whatever that thing is, it's working here. And that's why, have you ever seen the movie, The Neverending Story?
No.
Oh, that's another one. I'm gonna make a list of links I want to send Allison. But it's a, The Neverending Story is a children's story. It's been made into a movie. And basically, it's this young boy, and he's fighting because there's a force taking over the universe called the Nothing. Okay? Mm. So the Nothing is eating the universe, and he's got to stop it. And so it's his journey, you know, it's the hero's journey, and how he tries to stop the Nothing from destroying and taking all the meaning out of the universe. And that's what these guys are doing. They're trying to suck up and control and own all the meaning. And you know, and the problem is that shrinks the meaning down to nothing. Anyway, so it's very appropriate.
I'm going to have to ring off in a little bit, but I'm going to New York. I'm going to be part of the thing tomorrow. And I just finished New York. So it's that, but when you think of the synchronicities, right? So it's at Foley Square is where it's, and I looked, because I'm not from New York, so I looked on Google, and I'm like, it's right next to the African burial ground. And I'm like, this is this domination, right? This is this longer history. They're walking Broadway, that's the Lenape Trail. Like, there's these layers of intertwining histories, like our fates, their fates, they're all meshed up together. And so afterwards, I'm going to be doing a couple of revocations of consent we've been doing and saying.
I heard about this. This is really fascinating. Can you just tell us quickly what it is?
Yeah. So, well, we did, though, our first one was on Easter Sunday outside the Council on Foreign Relations.
I heard that. Yeah.
So on Saturday, we're going to be doing one at the Wall Street Bowl and then at the Stock Exchange, but also the House of Morgan and Federal Hall. So that's that intersection. And then we're going to the New York Fed.
Perfect. Okay. Would you ask them for our $21 trillion? Actually, now it's up to $100 trillion. Ask them for the $100 trillion that disappeared illegally through their hands.
So we're trying to resonate love. And that's what I just want to emphasize for people is that I think especially now this energy, I think it feeds on fear and anger. And right. I see more and more within the resistance community. And I'm not saying like just set aside what people's fears are, but like consider how you're acting in the space. Are you resonating from
right
a darker, because that's getting really strong the last few weeks, right? And I think that love wins. And my book, my children's book that I'm bringing is the Wrinkle in Time.
Oh, great.
Theory and physics and love and faith And at the end, it's IT that they're up against, right? It's this technocracy. And so Meg breaks, she says, you know, I'm just looking over this passage again. And she said, hate, like, I hate this thing. And, but she's like, hate is what it does have. What does it not have? And it didn't have love. And she's like, I can't love the IT, but I can love my brother who was trapped in it. And so that was the force that broke it. And when we think about, like, like the golden kernel that we have in us, the unexpected, the synchronicity, because the work I do is largely just piecing together some of, a lot of it's like my own poking around, but I have gifts. Like walking this road, you find people and they Right. give you teachings and they give you knowledge and gifts. It's a gift economy of elaborating this other way of being, this alternative to what they're proposing. And so yeah, I would encourage if folks, well, this won't air till afterwards, but I think we might have a video recording of these revocations. But we're taking dandelions and I'm leaving the book. I ask people to send me their good intentions for the children and I'm writing them in the book and I'm leaving it at the base of the Wall Street Bull statue.
Right. So the way the never ending story ends, I hate to give it away, is, the young gentleman has one last wish and he turns to the nothing and he says, I wish you had a heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so, right. So,
that
so
energetic thing, you know?
Yeah. So the last thing I think the reason you don't want to get angry, I'm not saying don't hold accountable, but getting angry at something creates a connection between that thing and you that you don't want to. You don't want to create that pathway.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right. So we're trying to raise up. So we don't want to create that pathway. We want to shift up anyway. And I think it's very important to look at the system. If you look at how the law, both the formal and informal law works and say, we don't consent.
Yeah.
You know, so much of the hopelessness encouragement is to try and get you to consent because consent is very important. So.
I don't think you need, I mean, it would be great if eventually we had, you know, tens of thousands of people, but I do believe that, you know, even in the space, if this is happening energetically, that you shouldn't not do it because you don't have the numbers you think you should have. Sometimes
I don't think you need the numbers.
Small group individuals in the space and time is enough. And I've seen that in Philadelphia, things that, you know, I did an impromptu sit-in at the Union League. I was trying to get in this meeting with this about the schools and they said, you have jeans on. I chalked no philanthrocapitalism all over the sidewalk around the Union League. And they were so angry with me and they did not know what to do with me. Like I was the thing that showed up and they're like, how did this thing get in the hallway? You know? And mm-hmm. It disrupted that thing. And I didn't even do it on purpose. I mean, I did the chalking on purpose, but not the other part. The bow tie man came after me and tried to grab my ticket. And I'm like, just sat in the hallway and they had to step over me the whole time. But it's these disruptions in the waveform. They're these waveforms. Yes. It signals intelligence. That's what Bloomberg
But the other thing is, if you look at this complex bubble they've created, it all depends on you being able to take all that pretzel talk seriously. And once you understand that it's all complete.
Oh, this.
Yeah. You know, so you have to pull the rug out from under the credibility of it. You know, so and I think that's what you're doing. So, Allison, I know you've got to go. Thank you very much for joining me. I hope this is the first of many conversations. I have a list of links to send to you, but if there's anything we can do to help, would you let us know? We're happy to promote. If you're going to show up with a group of people and do a not consent, we're happy to give everybody notice so they can show up.
Yeah, I'll send a link to my Dandelion Manifesto. People can send me dandelions too. I have my address there. And
okay.
Yeah, thank you. I think if we can get people to understand the poverty, the blockchain, the connection between the medical and the poverty and this long history of domination and the children. Like to me, that is a very unifying piece.
Well, to me, this is a plan that will create, essentially will reduce most people to poverty and slavery.
Yeah. So, and I think the professional class doesn't believe it yet, but we have to convince them that they do it for their children because it's coming from schools.
One of my favorite, Rappaport calls it Hotel Auschwitz. Well, because they like to make it look sort of hotel-like and friendly, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, I feel like we're in the ghost dance time, so we have to be prepared, but I don't think it's going to turn out the way they think. So
no, that I know. That I know, you know, may you resonate, everybody listening, may you resonate with life and not with machines.
Exactly.
So Allison, have a great day. And again, thank you for everything you're doing.
Connect with another Philly person.
Say hello to William Penn. Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.